Well, join me today for a special interview with author Joel Richardson. We'll talk about God's redemptive purposes in the midst of end times catastrophes.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on today's Line of Fire broadcast. I'm going to be joined at the bottom of the hour by author Joel Richardson. Maybe you've read some of his books about the Islamic Antichrist or about millennial promises to Israel. We're going to have a fascinating discussion about God's redemptive purposes in the midst of last days catastrophes. And as we talked yesterday about the California fires, and I've got an article about that written with sensitivity in light of the tremendous human loss and great human suffering. It's going to be an important interview. But before we get to that, I want to cover a couple of different things with you. And phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I want to talk to you about the migrant caravan and a perspective from a missionary living in Honduras. Many years ago, I was preaching in Juarez, Mexico, and I was speaking to the pastor of the church there. It was a church of about 8,000 people in Juarez, and he was an American who had been living and working and serving in Mexico for probably 40 years. So was in El Paso, Texas, was in Juarez back and forth all the time, but serving the people of Mexico for decades. And I asked him how he felt about illegal aliens coming into America. And he was adamant. He was adamant. He said, you know all the laws they have to break to do that? You know how wrong? He was adamant. And there were others with him in Mexico who were adamant about it as well. So on the one hand, we want to have compassion on those who have legitimate need and would qualify as refugees to whom we'd open our borders, who'd become productive citizens of America. On the other hand, yeah, we are a nation of laws. And just like you close your door at night, you lock your car door, you do things like that. Just like there's a wall around the Vatican. I mean, there is certain things that these things are put in place for protection, right? It's common sense. So there's an article on the stream by Jennifer Zilli Canales. Her first article was shared hundreds of thousands of times. It was shared over 400,000 times on Facebook from the stream article. It was previously posted in a newspaper somewhere. Editor found it, posted it on the stream. The thing went completely viral. And this was a woman living in real poverty by choice with family, raising children, I think some not her own, and just caring for the needy and the family suffering and her husband being beaten. And just, I mean, it was an incredible story. But she's got a follow-up article that I want to share with you, all right? So this is a missionary in Honduras. Don't validate anarchy here by letting the caravan in. So here's an American woman living, I presume American, living in Honduras, giving herself to the people of Honduras. This is what she says. A few days ago, my Honduran husband returned to our rural mission property on one of our family bikes. He had made a quick trip down the long gravel road into the more populated part of our Honduran town. As he pulled up next to me, I greeted him warmly on my way to the weekly chess class I teach for the youth in our school. His uneasy facial expression immediately caught me off guard. His face normally reflects very open, easy joy and inspires the trust of those around him. Beads of sweat covered his face. I sensed a great uneasiness within him, although he wasn't saying anything. I stopped in my tracks on our dusty front lawn, a once nice grass yard since worn down from many soccer games, and asked him what had happened. He tried to gently shoo me off to my class. I was already running a few minutes late. I refused to leave his side until he told me what had happened. With a bit more probing and persistence, he gave in and shared in a hushed, almost nervous voice, I was visiting our neighbors where they sell the drugs to the local kids. I got pretty mad, told them to leave our students alone. They just started laughing. I got really riled up, but everything will be okay. Are they going to kill you? I asked instinctively, knowing how dangerous it can be in Honduras to become anyone's enemy. He hesitated. beads of sweat, probably a combination of nerves and the blistering heat, continued to populate his forehead. Then he answered reassuredly with a forced grin, "Not this time." He knows he has to answer this way to put my own mind at ease, and he was just convincing enough to do so this time. I knew exactly which house he was talking about and why he had taken matters into his own hands. He had already called the local police several times about. The police assured him casually that they already knew the location of the house and the illegal activity going on there. The nonchalant tone and ensuing inaction meant one thing. They had no move, nor did they plan to do so. My husband was trying to look out for the best interest of our local students and protect them from danger. He left his conversations with the police feeling bewildered at their apathy and frustrated with their total lack of initiative. Lee was not at all surprised. This has generally been the reaction, or lack thereof, that we have roused from the Honduran police in times of need. My husband, a Christian pianist who organizes youth choirs and has a passion for mentoring at-risk teens, was kidnapped by local gang members 2 years ago and literally beaten within an inch of his life. The organized group had mistaken him for someone from an enemy gang. We were on a marriage retreat at the time, and he left our cabin in the early morning to go walk and pray. He was quietly walking near a remote stream when they found him, 7 men against 1, and violently swooped him off to their hideout up in the mountains where they beat him for several hours. With death music blasting and my husband tightly gagged, each man took turns hitting my husband with rods, shoes, and the like. They repeatedly threatened him with death. He admitted that he was ready should they take his life, and miraculously they let him go. Stumbling through an expansive pine field, hardly able to walk, he made the journey to a highway police station and was able to find help. Minutes later, he showed up in the police car at the Little Inn we had been staying in, clothes ripped and his body bent from pain and completely dirty and bloody, with this weakened boy-like grin on his face, despite all the odds. I felt like I was trudging through a dense fog that entire day. We took him to the emergency room, accompanied by a family friend and 2 very kind police officers. I kept thinking, it is not the police's job to accompany victims to hospitals. The police's job is to investigate the crime, to seek out the perpetrators, and to do justice. They're wasting time here. They should be out on the streets and acting justice. Throughout our stay in the desperately undersupplied hospital, I stared numbly at the police officers as they helped my husband stand up and lie down on the various patient tables. I couldn't help thinking, thank you for your kindness and concern, which is evident and heartwarming, but please go do your job. Please go hunt those guys down so they don't beat anyone else. My husband has already told you exactly where they were. Please do something. You are the police. Lying on an uncovered hospital bed next to my husband was another young man in similar shape, but with no one tending to him. He had huge bleeding wounds on his face and body. I made eye contact with him, but didn't dare ask what had happened to him. Despite our urging, the 2 police officers made no promise to help. No police action was ever taken. The neighborhood where the gang beat my husband almost to death remains a very dangerous area dominated by lawlessness. She continues, any Honduran could tell countless other stories of corruption and lack of police response. All lead to disorder and despair on a national level. Currently, an international audience is watching on television what we see played out daily. That is large masses who have very little respect for laws, boundaries, and authority. They act as they do in large part because they have not had a healthy authority to trust in. Nor do they understand that actual consequences await when one breaks the law. I know that my experience is very limited and that my viewpoint is not shared by all Hondurans or Americans. But we who live here know too many cases in which the Honduran law is not respected or upheld. Too many cases in which no real consequences are dealt to the lawbreakers. The same people commit violent crimes over and over again, even as the police are fully informed but do nothing. This creates confusion, chaos, and even desperation. I work alongside of highly educated, well-informed Hondurans every day in the context of our mission school. I hear and agree with their diverse opinions on the various challenges Hondurans faces. We understand the migrant caravan to be a desperate cry for help. We know that the caravan represents many Hondurans seeking political change and increased security for this country, which it desperately needs. But it's simply untrue that the answer for a safer, more prosperous Honduras is that thousands should leave illegally. This is a very complex matter, and I do not claim to be an expert or hold all the answers, but I do affirm that the problem largely lies in the lack of public order in Honduras. This change must be enacted from the top down. The current lack of order leads to the formation of citizens who have very little respect for laws and for one another. They, in turn, wreak havoc on the country's law-abiding citizens who are powerless to stop them. The caravan is simply the visible result of the chaos that occurs on Honduran soil daily. Letting the immigrants pass the United States border will only cause further damage to Honduras. Does the U.S. want to validate the abounding belief that laws can be broken and authority disrespected with no unfavorable results? This will only increase the already strong anarchy in Honduras. Honduras needs real justice, discipline, and a defined set of laws and punishment that actually gets fulfilled. This would most likely require the help of an overseeing, transparent international community, as Honduras has not yet been able to foster justice and create a prosperous nation alone. Rather than receive several thousand who have arrived at the borders, help us restore the millions that remain in the country. The solution is not a migrant caravan, escaping a myriad of problems. Letting the caravan pass across the border will most likely lead to more caravans in the future. And instead, we need new long-term solutions right here on Honduran soil. By the way, I should have just checked the end of the article to confirm the details. So Jennifer Zilli Canales is an American citizen who has served as a missionary in Honduras full-time since 2012. She and her husband Darwin are foster parents to seven precious Honduran children ages 10 to 18 and serve as executive directors and teachers at the Living Waters Ranch Mission School for local at-risk youth. She maintains a blog at Hidden Treasures in Honduras. That's up on the stream. You can also read there my latest article, Where Was God When California Burned, which builds on some of the things we shared on the broadcast yesterday with love, with sensitivity, and with care. Okay, why did I take the time to read that to you? I do not comment much on issues having to do with immigration. Why? One reason is I'm not expert on it. Another reason is can't focus on everything. Another reason is God has not called me particularly to address those issues, and there are others that are doing a fine job of addressing them. So I'm not trying to be jack of all trades and expert on all things. You hear me talk very little about the economy, for example. Of course, the economy matters, but not my area of expertise or burden or calling. And there are plenty of fine economists out there. But I share this with you because often we don't think anything about the home country. We just think about the people, or the criminals among them, or the needy people among them. What does Mexico think about them? People of Mexico happy to have them there? And we don't think, like, what about on the home front in Honduras? And according to Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, leading Hispanic evangelical spokesman here in America, he said that they have firsthand information that some of the caravan was stirred by left-wing activists in Honduras. So it wasn't just a humanitarian thing. And there are many needs in Honduras, as this sister explains to us. But often there are larger perspectives. So I don't present this as an easy answer to anything. In fact, it raises more issues, bigger issues, more difficult issues. Rather say they're bigger perspectives. And boy, the nations of the world need the gospel, and they need justice, they need wisdom, they need righteousness. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In a few minutes, I'll be joined with Joel Richardson talking about his brand new book. Really interested to have this conversation with him. But first, I received an email. It was forwarded to me this morning. Dr. Brown, I'm an officer with the Salvation Army. And I'm not going to say where, all right? I don't know if you're aware that officers are also ordained ministers in the Wesleyan holiness tradition. The Salvation Army started in 1865 with a mission to win the world to Jesus Christ. Recently, the international leadership of the Salvation Army made a decision that officers should not be allowed to post on their social media on the topics of abortion and LGBTQ marriage. Staff are also discouraged from doing so. I feel this is a devastating move. There are so many ministers and congregations in the Salvation Army of America that they are silencing a significant amount of clergy with this move on issues that are very much related to the gospel. Todd Starnes has rewritten on this, and I assure you his report is accurate. Please comment on this. We need your voice of moral guidance. I believe an open letter from a voice like yours may be appropriate, but any response will be helpful. All right, I want to go to this Todd Starnes article in a moment. But some of you hearing that may be confused and say, Salvation Army, what's that got to do with the gospel? And why would they even care about issues like abortion or same-sex quote marriage or Salvation Army just collects money to feed the poor. Salvation Army just helps people, helps the needy. And, you know, at Christmas time, they stand in front of stores and they ring the bells and you give them money, you give them your change when you leave the store, you put a dollar bill in there, whatever, and they raise hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, whatever, and they give that to the poor and the needy. And so what's that got to do with the gospel as far as preaching salvation or, okay. I didn't know about the origins of the Salvation Army until probably the late 80s. And it was as I got close with Leonard Ravenhill, and he gave me a set of books. He and his wife Martha gave Nancy and me a set of books called Aggressive Christianity, six volumes of sermons by Catherine Booth. I remember that we had them just sitting on this little table that was in the kitchen. And when I would walk past them, I would see in my mind's eye steam coming out of them. I mean, they were passionate, hot, red hot gospel. And William Booth, his whole burden to go to the sinners, go to the worst. I read an account that he had traveled over to Australia and had his first night of meetings. And he's an older man at this point, and it's quite a journey, you know, by boat to get over, gets to Australia. And he has the opening night's meeting, and the meeting hall is packed out and wonderfully successful meeting. And William Booth says, "Where are the prostitutes? Where are the drunkards? Where are those are the people I came for. I didn't come here for church people." So they went out on the streets and they got in all these other people. And then Booth preached them because that's what he lived for. So he felt this tremendous burden, his wife, Catherine, to bring the gospel to the worst of sinners, to the most helpless of sinners, to the outcast, and to go into the neediest parts of London. I mean, crime-ridden and rat-infested and poverty-stricken and terrible needs and just unimaginable suffering on a daily basis, and to bring the gospel there. And for him, of course, it's one and the same, that the same gospel that offers forgiveness offers help to suffering people. You don't come with a Bible in one hand and food in the other and say, "All right, here's the message of Jesus. I'm going to eat the food while you starve to death." No, here's the message of Jesus, and here's the food you need to live because God cares about you. So Salvation Army was ablaze, and Salvation Army workers went around the world preaching the gospel, many of them living sacrificially. Great holiness preachers among them. Samuel Logan Brengel was one of my favorite early Salvation Armyists, a holiness preacher. In fact, if I recall, his definition of holiness was pure love. It gets you thinking of things from a different angle. And it's over the decades that Salvation Army has become known to most as an exclusively humanitarian group, yes, of Christian origin, but not a gospel preaching group. Well, my thinking continued to change about the Salvation Army as I began to meet Salvation Army officers over the years. And as one of the grads from our ministry school joined the Salvation Army, and this is a gospel preaching man. Yeah, they wear the army outfits and they have these different rankings. That's just their system. But I mean, you're talking about gospel preaching, Jesus loving, word revering people. And there have been some conflicts. If I recall, it was in Australia that there were some conflicts over this in terms of ethical issues or potential compromise on same-sex, quote, marriage. I remember being in China with 40 evangelical leaders, meeting with Chinese leaders a few years back at the invitation of Franklin Graham. And one of the leaders was a former head of the Salvation Army. We talked extensively about these things, but this man was a committed believer, a God-honoring believer. Was not a Christian in name only. He was a believer and strongly committed to the Lord. But obviously, if your bottom line is we want to receive the maximum amount of funds to give to help the poor and needy around the world, which the Salvation Army does beautifully and wonderfully, we want to do this. And in order to do this, we're going to avoid all social controversies. Then I can understand the motivation, but you've got gospel preachers here. You've got people that feel that their flocks are confused, that their followers are confused. They need to weigh in. They need to give scripture. They need to give truth here. And are you not going to trust God that you can do the right thing and he can bring in the funds anyway? So Todd Starnes has an exclusive article, came out 2 days ago, Salvation Army warns officers to stop posting about gay marriage. It says this: if you run into a Salvation Army bell ringer this Christmas season, don't strike up a conversation about President Trump or gay marriage. Salvation Army personnel have been told to stop posting their opinions about gay marriage, abortion, or anything political on social media because it might reflect poorly on the organization, according to an internal email and guidelines obtained by the Todd Starnes radio show. A number of Salvation Army personnel reached out to me to express their concerns that the organization is embroiled in a battle between biblical conservatives and progressives, and they fear the progressives are winning the day. Quote, political or social opinions, such as hot topics like LGBTQ marriage, officer housing, or abortion, should not be included in profiles, and officers should refrain from posting anything that expresses a political view, the guidelines for Salvation Army officers state. The Salvation Army introduced new social media guidelines to combat and, quote, increased number of complaints regarding comments made on social media by Salvation Army officers and staff. This is a threat to our reputation, our fundraising efforts, and ultimately our ability to serve people in need. And the article goes on from there. Okay. On the one hand, I understand the motivation, as much as I differ with where it's going. I understand the motivation. Here, look, our mission, let's just picture this, okay? I'm at a food distribution truck and feeding homeless people. And this is the only mission. That's the one and only thing I'm there to do is to get food to the homeless people. What do you think about President Trump before? Well, that's really not the issue. Well, who'd you vote for, Hillary or Donald? That's really not the issue. I want to know where you stand on the migrant caravan. But really, that's not the issue. And 100 other things. That's not the issue. The issue is I've got food to deliver to these homeless people, and that's why I'm here. And I can't engage you in a lengthy discussion about it because I've got to give food to the homeless people. Well, I want to know, I'm giving my money to you. I want to know where you stand on the president. Really, I'm not material because if you give the money to me, it's going to buy more sandwiches for the homeless people and I'm going to give it to them. I understand the mentality. The problem is that the Salvation Army, by its history and purpose, was first and foremost a gospel preaching organization that then also got involved in meeting the needs of individuals. I mean, and William Booth even tried to come up with a plan of taking the poorest of the poor from England and bringing them somewhere else. I mean, not everything was the best plan, but the overall heart, the overall intent, the activities, the wonderfully conceived and living out the gospel. But it was preaching Jesus first, helping the needy second, although they would go hand in hand. And often the way you'd preach the gospel was by helping the needy. But it was never to the exclusion of preaching the gospel. And again, Salvation Army officers are not secular people. They are gospel-ordained people. They are clergy, to use our common terms. All right? Yeah, I don't believe in a clergy-lady distinction in gossip, but that's, you understand what I'm saying, okay? So to tell them you can't post on controversial issues. So, well, hang on. Time out. So you want me to feed the poor. That's good. It's good to feed the poor. But I can't address the slaughter of the unborn. So care for the poor, care for the needy. Yeah, I'm all in on that. But I can't address crimes against the unborn. I can't address the slaughter of innocent babies. I can talk about feeding a poor person here, but not killing a baby here. I'm not allowed to do that. And I'm supposed to preach the Bible and hold to biblical ethics. But when my flock and people and followers are confused about homosexuality and where we stand on marriage, I'm not allowed to comment on those things. I could understand saying, please don't post anything about politics. Okay, it's an overlap thing, but I can understand that distinction. But to say you can't post anything about abortion and you're a Wesleyan holiness ordained clergy member serving the organization founded by William and Catherine Booth, yeah, that's scary. So keep giving, whether it be Salvation Army or other places to help the poor and the needy. But let's pray for the Salvation Army to get this right, that they can do good in the days ahead. We'll be right back with Joel Richardson. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire. The most recent article that I wrote asked the question, where was God when California burned? So the question of God's activity or inactivity during the tragic California forest fires that have taken so many lives, that article is live on the stream and elsewhere online. And we always treat subjects like this with great care. Talked about this subject on the radio yesterday because it's not just theology. We're talking about human lives. We're talking about terrible suffering. So when we try to play God, we need to be very careful and not speak beyond what we know, but yet be here to bring words of comfort and redemption. Well, in light of what we've been talking about and what I just wrote about, I've got a fascinating guest with a fascinating book. Joel Richardson has been on with us before. We've talked about end time prophecy, the possibility of an Islamic Antichrist, God's future for Israel. But he has a brand new book called The Mystery of Catastrophe, which presents a clear biblical case for God's plans and purposes amidst tragedy. And the book is just out now. So, Joel, welcome back to The Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us.
Dr. Brown, thanks so much for having me back.
So, Joel, how did you get to this subject, a little bit different than some of your prophetic books, but on the other hand, with overlap, because I imagine you expect to see more and more shaking as we get closer and closer to the end of the age?
Yeah, well, there are some similarities in the book in terms of some of the things that I've written about in the past. Obviously, we deal with the end times, but even more so, it's more than an eschatological book. It's a very missional book. It's a very pastoral book. It's more than just sort of what's going to happen in the last days, but in light of what's going to happen, how should we respond? What should our primary heart posture be? What questions we should be asking and this sort of thing? So this is probably the most applicational project that I've been part of. And because of that, I actually feel as though it's probably the most important.
And Joel, wrestling with issues like this is not easy. If we just get caught up in theology and abstraction while people are dying, then we're really insensitive. On the other hand, if we focus so much on human beings and lose divine perspective, then we don't really have an answer. How did you strike a balance between trying to have God's perspective and God's heart while at the same time looking at real human need?
Yeah, so, you know, if we're dealing with, for instance, you mentioned the forest fires, the fires in California. Well, in situations like that, you can pretty much bank on the fact that there's going to be all kinds of Christians out there that are going to be arguing whether or not this is the punishment of God, the judgment of God on California, or whether or not it's the, you know, the plans of Satan and this sort of thing. You can sort of have those debates forever. Or let's say we're talking about the caravan from South America. You're going to have everyone arguing from the right or from the left. You know, well, should we let them in? Should we not let them in? What's the right, you know, political response? And what we're trying to do is say, look, we can sort of have those discussions. We can have those discussions forever. But the real questions that we should be asking is, in the midst of tragedy, what might God be doing? What are the gospel opportunities? And so it's really just an issue of we're trying to change the questions that are being asked. We're trying to say, if these things are going to increase before the return of Jesus, if we're going to see more natural and man-made disasters, then what should our attitude be? You know, we live in an age right now where everything revolves around the political debate. And we're not saying the political debate is not relevant. It's very relevant. It has real-world implications. But as Christians, as followers of Jesus, we need to be looking at the bigger, the larger redemptive purposes behind all of it, and to say, how can we partner with God in light of all the things that are unfolding in the earth right now and the things that will be increasingly unfolding in the earth in the days ahead?
And, you know, we have a paradigm when we see Jesus dealing with certain situations. For example, in John 9 that I included in my article and a caller referenced on the show yesterday, where he and the disciples see a man born blind, and the disciples, based on their Jewish theology and Old Testament precedent, ask who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind. Obviously, somebody sinned specifically to get this result. Maybe the man sinned in the womb. Maybe his parents sinned. And Jesus first dismisses that in this case and says, neither this man sinned nor his parents that he was born blind. And he says, but this happened so that the works of God might be made manifest. In other words, by healing the man. So what's interesting is Jesus never says, well, the reason he's blind is X, Y, Z, or God did it, or whatever. It's part of the fallen human race. He doesn't say anything. Doesn't mention the devil, but it's an occasion through which God can be glorified. So what you're saying is, yeah, we do know that there's been catastrophe on the earth as long as the earth has been here. It seems from Scripture that there's going to be increasing shaking as we get closer to the end of the age. How can we be redemptive in the midst of it? So let's start to break this down. You start off in your book with also help from Nathan Graves, laying out a biblical theology of catastrophe. What in the world is a biblical theology of catastrophe?
Well, we're beginning with the assumption, and I'm going to say we're kind of throwing in a little sort of John Piper-esque. We're mirroring some of the things that we've heard Piper say over the years, which is a theology of understanding that God's ultimate purpose is that he would be glorified. He would be glorified throughout history, throughout the earth. So, you know, we go back to the beginning. You look at different events. I think one of the favorite examples in the biblical record is the story of Joseph. Now, you know, we know in retrospect that when all is said and done, you know, Joseph looks at his brothers and he says, listen, you know, you guys sold me into slavery, for goodness sakes. He says, but what you intended for evil, he says, God intended for good. He intended that in order to prepare basically salvation for all of you guys so that I could go ahead and help save you guys. Now, if you go back to the years that Joseph was, you know, living in difficulty and everything, and you say, well, God is in this. And people are going to get all upset and say, well, you're trying to say that God supports human trafficking and, you know, this sort of thing. You can get all in all kinds of ridiculous arguments. But if you step back and recognize that God has always had a larger redemptive purpose, then you start asking the different questions. You say, in the midst of this difficult thing, the situation which seems to just be wrought by the hand of Satan or wrought by the hand of evil men, what might God be doing for his larger redemptive purposes? So really, we trace a lot of examples of catastrophe throughout redemptive history, and we show that principle, that Romans 8:28, you know, he causes all things to work out for the good of those that love him, and ultimately for his own glory, for his own redemptive purposes. We show that that's consistent throughout history, and if that's the case, then we should look for that in our day as well.
So would it be parallel to the idea that there's no resurrection without crucifixion first, or the modern history of Israel born out of the ashes of the Holocaust, that God often brings life out of death and hope out of despair, and then that often the hopeless end is just the beginning of something filled with hope? Would you see those as parallels?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, it's interesting, too, because you brought up the issue of divine healing. You know, you're charismatic, I'm charismatic. I believe that the church needs to have a solid theology of healing. But I also believe the charismatic church also needs to have a pretty good theology of suffering and of the cross. And to understand that, you know, look, if it's down to, and it's not always this simple, but if it's down to, you know, I enter the kingdom with a gimpy foot but a humble heart, the Lord's going to go for a humble heart any day of the week. And so, you know, that again, that's an overly simplified, you know, it's not often that simple. But God has heart issues first, and if he can bring about you know, the glory of his own name and further salvation through healings, then he's going to do that. But oftentimes, you know, he doesn't. And so sometimes we have this theology that says if we just jump through the certain hoops and conform to these different principles, then God will always heal us every single time, or he'll always prosper us every single time, this sort of thing. And the fact of the matter is the biblical record doesn't bear that out. Now, in the age to come, at the resurrection, everyone in Christ, we're all getting healed. No one's leaving the healing meeting, you know, with their headache 30% better. Everyone's getting healed eventually. But sometimes in this age, he allows a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And that's exactly what Jesus did. It says that he left us an example. You know, it was suffering before glory. And that's how we should relate to the cross in this age. It's something to be embraced. It's not just a a vending machine to give us everything we want now and in the age to come.
Yeah, and even in Matthew 5, Jesus says better to enter heaven maimed, speaking figuratively, than with two hands and two feet to go into hell. Joel, is there a pattern we can find in Scripture of God being involved in catastrophe, storms, earthquakes, tsunamis? On the one hand, insurance policies call these acts of God. On the other hand, there are Christians today who say, no, God does not actively do those things, or it's Satan who tried to drown Jesus and the disciples in a storm. And you have a chapter in the book, His Way is in the Whirlwind and the Storm. So do you have a theology about that? Can you go from that to look at events today and say God is doing this or God is not doing that? Or is that the wrong application of Scripture?
You know, I'll be honest with you. As the old preacher once said, you know, God and the devil are after me. And, whenever there's a storm or this sort of thing, you know, you've got examples in the Bible where it says, you know, God sent an evil spirit. Another one says that the devil, another parallel passage says the devil sent a deceiving spirit and this sort of thing. So you can sort of wrestle through these things. And I'll be honest with you, in terms of sort of the larger, I guess I'll call it the Arminian Calvinist debate, my stance is I don't dwell on things that are too great for me. If I'm to be honest, these things are beyond me. And so I'm sort of, you know, both an Arminian and a Calvinist. I believe in the sovereignty of God, but I believe in the free will and responsibility of man. But, you know, so again, we can argue, we can just debate, we can, you know, theologize about these things forever. But the point is we can look at examples. You know, you touched on storms, natural disasters. I think another big thing that we hit on in the book a lot, because my co-author, by the way, Nathan Graves, he's a veteran missionary. He's been, he's just a solid Baptist missionary. He's been in Albania for 24 years. He was thrown in as a missionary, sort of baptized by fire, right in the middle of the Bosnian Wars, three wars throughout the 1990s, ministering to people, Muslims who were dealing with Christians that were slaughtering their villages and the other sort of thing. And so he was kind of plunged into that, and then he was there throughout the whole Muslim refugee crisis the past few years with refugees pouring through Eastern Europe, through the Balkans, up into Western Europe. And so one of the issues that we hit on a lot is the issue of the movement of population.
All right, stay right there. We'll come back to finish that thought on the other side of the break. I'm just looking at the table of contents here. Some pretty intense stuff. We're going to get into it when we come back. Stay right here. The new book, Joel Richardson, Nathan Graves, The Mystery of Catastrophe.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking today with best-selling author Joel Richardson. He and his co-author Nathan Graves have a brand new book out, literally brand new, The Mystery of Catastrophe. Some of the chapter titles, Mystery of Catastrophe, Present-Day Examples, The Big Picture of Catastrophe. And then the second part of the book, What Comes Next? A World of Catastrophe, The Last Reich, The Spirit of Antichrist, The Lord's purpose for the Antichrist, our response, how then shall we respond? The grand climax, rising to the times, a missionary for the times. So as Joel said, this is an eminently practical book. So Joel, you were talking about massive population movements and the suffering or cataclysmic results that brings. So back to you.
Okay, so, you know, another great example in the New Testament is after the martyrdom of Stephen, you had the dispersion of the Jerusalem church. Now, again, at that moment, you know, if Twitter existed back then, I'm sure people would be complaining, well, how come the authorities didn't protect us from persecution? And, you know, they'd be all upset and this sort of thing. But rather than grumbling and complaining and just focusing on those things, what the scriptures say is that the believers boldly shared the gospel everywhere they went, everywhere that they were dispersed, displaced. The early church would displace people, and as a result of that, like a grease fire, the gospel spread all over the ancient world. And so again, you know, there's a situation. At the time, you don't think God is in this, but God was in it. He used it for the spread of the gospel. And so, you know, a perfect example today is the massive Muslim refugee crisis. We had roughly a million Muslims pour through Turkey, through Eastern Europe. And so, again, you know, the endless debates, on the right, on the left, are we for it? Are we against it? What is the compassionate? What is the Christ-like thing? And I think those on the right, and I'm very conservative, tended to, by and large, just be firmly against it. This is an invasion. These are all men of military age, et cetera. You know, you see all the videos, angry Uncle Joe sends the emails out and, you know, this sort of thing. And then those that are a bit more missions-focused or sometimes a little bit more politically left, they say, well, we need to be more compassion-oriented and this sort of thing. And again, we're not telling people you don't have to have an opinion. What we're saying is, whether you're for it or against it is almost irrelevant. Regardless as to our political stance, we have an obligation and an opportunity to share the gospel. And so, you know, with Nathan a few years ago, when this whole thing was happening, I did a couple little programs on my little YouTube show. We raised almost $100,000. And what we did is we got micro SD cards. We loaded them up with Bibles in multiple languages. And Nathan organized a whole bunch of the churches throughout the Balkans, and they set up little cell phone charging stations. So as the refugees were pouring through, they would stop and charge their phones, and they would say, we've got these micro SD cards. It's got the Bible in your language on it. Would you like us to put this into your phone? And about 95% of these Muslims said, yes, absolutely. It also had the addresses of churches in Western Europe that had said, look, when you get here, we want to minister to you. And as a result of that, you know, again, whether you're for it or against it, the government's going to do what they're going to do. But as a result of that, Nathan just got back from a visit to a church where there was about 24 new believers, all former Muslims from Iran, from Kurdistan, and Syria. And, you know, that was as a direct result of that initiative. And so, you know, there's good things that are coming out of the refugee crisis. God is using it. But if we just focus on the political side of things, we're going to miss gospel opportunities. And so, you know, these tragedies are real, but they're also opportunities.
You know, we have a growing team in Kurdistan. And I think, you know, some of the folks that are involved there, and they felt called there, so to northern Iraq. And not long after they got there to serve the people and preach the gospel, the refugee crisis broke from Syria. And before they knew it, literally in their backyard, I mean, not that literally, but right where they were living, almost in their backyard, there are now hundreds of thousands of refugees, both true Christian, nominal Christian, and Muslim. And they've had an incredible opportunity to share with these needy people. And yeah, it's a terrible thing. There's great tragedy in it, but in all of it, there's the opportunity for redemption. Having said that, though, let me challenge you to play the devil's advocate here. Aren't you going a little too far when you talk about the Lord's purpose for the Antichrist? I mean, what in the world could be redemptive about an Antichrist and tribulation and these kinds of things? And yet that's the ultimate catastrophe, you could say. So what's the redemptive side to that, Joel?
You know, I'll tell you a funny story. Years ago, I had one of these little calendars that would have a Bible verse for each day. And one of the days I ripped open the page and it said, he will prosper in all he does. And it was Daniel 8. And I looked at that and it was supposed to be an inspirational Bible verse for the day. And I said, wait a minute, that's talking about the Antichrist. That verse is talking about the Antichrist. And so you've actually got verses in Daniel 8 and Daniel 11. Where it actually says that the Antichrist will prosper in all he does in waging war against God's holy people. And so I know it sounds difficult to say God's purpose for the Antichrist, but in the sovereignty of God, you know, the Lord has actually chosen to allow this, I'll say, rod of chastisement to be used against his people Israel, to be used against the unbelievers of the earth, and in a lot of ways to even purify his church. And it actually says that he will prosper. I sometimes joke and I say, Joel, people say, do you believe in the prosperity gospel? I say, well, the Bible clearly says that the Antichrist is going to prosper. And so, you know, I know it's kind of silly, but the point is that, yes, even the Antichrist, the Lord has purposed from before time to be used to purify and to refine his church, and to chastise his people Israel. Because in the end, and, you know, Moses himself talked about this, you know, in the end, in the last days, the Lord is going to allow Israel to come to the, he says, the end of her strength. And then he interjects and he says, so where are your false gods now? Where are your idols now? He says, behold, you know, look, I'm revealing myself. I'm the one that brings life. I'm the one that brings death. And I'm the one that heals. And so, you know, I'm the only one that can bring life. And so this has been his way throughout redemptive history.
And really what I hear you saying is it's the same with the micro and the macro, that in each of our own personal lives, there are things that appear to be stumbling blocks, but they can become stepping stones. There are things that are the worst things that ever happened to us, and they become the best things that ever happened to us. There are things that in and of themselves are evil and wrong and bad, and sometimes the result of our own mistake or error. And yet, without those things, we wouldn't learn more about the Lord, or we wouldn't overcome certain mistakes, or even end up in certain places able to minister to certain people. So we've got to look at everything through the eyes of God being a redeemer. I think if that's our default value, Joel, if we start there, that God is a redeemer, regardless of why the thing happened, who brought it about, that there is a redemptive answer to it, that the same way it is in our personal lives, it's going to be no matter how big the calamity, the tragedy, how big the loss of life, how demonic the power. So what you're seeking to do now, believing that the days ahead, whether it's 5 years or 50 years or 100 years, that the days ahead will be fraught with upheaval and calamity, let's have that same redemptive outlook on all of life, including massive tragedy and calamity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you know, this is replete throughout the New Testament, you know, so many passages, you know, brothers and sisters, don't be surprised when all these trials and tribulations happen in your life, because if this stuff's not happening, then God's not even treating you like children, you know, because every loving father chastises his children. So, yeah, so on the personal level, this is, we do it with our children because we desire for them to grow up in maturity and in wisdom, and the Lord, he does it in our lives as well. And yeah, it can sound real insensitive, you know, at that moment of difficulty to say, well, God's in this, and that's not the point here. But the point is to practice asking different questions, that in the midst of it, to say, what redemptive purposes might God be providing in this moment? You know, how can I use this as an opportunity for growth? How can I use this as an opportunity to see the gospel spread? You know, again, the caravan coming up from the southern border, to say, here's another good question. What ministries might I be aware of, or that do I need to find out about, that are down there in Central America that are ministering, that I can partner with and support, that might be actual, you know, be ministering into this situation, this sort of thing. And so even back here in the United States, if we're not missionaries, you go, what does that have to do with me? Well, we can find out what ministries there are, if there's some big global crisis that's unfolding, and say, how can we partner with them? How can we pray for them? How can we support them? And it's just having a much more gospel-centered attitude.
Yeah, it really is. It boils down to that. And Joel, I was talking to Walter Heidenreich, one of the most respected Christian leaders I know in Germany, and a man who's really lived out his faith in very real ways for decades. And we were in Korea ministering together at a youth conference, and I asked him with a heavy heart, brother, what about the problems in Germany? And you know, the large number of Muslims in the country, just reading about the upheaval. And he looked at me and said, brother, what a great opportunity. He said, we can't get into Syria. Now they're in our country. We can reach them. Now, I don't say that solves all the political problems or issues, but his mentality was, here are people in need that have been brought to our doorstep. Friends, the new book, Joel Richardson and Nathan Graves, The Mystery of Catastrophe, it makes very relevant reading in the world in which we live, and probably be more relevant each year ahead. Joel, thanks for doing the hard work with your co-author. May the Lord use this to speak to many and minister to many.
Thank you so much, Michael.
God bless you. All right, friends, join us tomorrow right here on The Line of Fire. Until then, where do you go? AskDrBrown.org. Come on, visit us there. Let's spend a few hours together on our website. Talk to you tomorrow.